Back together again, you and I, for a busy midweek Wednesday edition, February 15th, 2023, of Connecticut Today, where I kicked off the show lauding four of the state's big city mayors for finally issuing ideas to battle repeat gun crime offenders. Republican State Rep. Greg Howard, who's also a police officer, weighed in on that subject as well. Connecticut News Junkie columnist Terry Cowgill returned to the show to offer his thoughts on a controversial bill in Hartford that would mandate that all citizens vote in Connecticut elections or be fined. Well, I guess eventually they all come around, don't they? You can be obstinate, you can dig your heels in, you can be like, when a dog or a cat doesn't want to move because they're afraid or they're happy where they are. You have a dog or cat that does that, cats can dig their claws really into the high pile carpet there, and man, you got to pry them off of that carpet. Or dogs, and they whimper, and they whelp, and they get mad because they're having fun, and they don't want to go home or move along on their walk. Well, apparently, the mayors of Connecticut's four biggest cities and the CCM, the Connecticut Conference of Municipalities, have finally seen the light. What's that biblical phrase? I'm sorry, I may be kind of paraphrasing this. And the blind shall see. What is it? And the crippled shall walk. Whatever, talking about a miraculous spiritual awakening here. But yesterday, while we were talking in the middle of the day, a group of the four big city mayors here in the state, which of course include Mayor O'Leary in Waterbury, Mayor Ganim in Bridgeport, Mayor Bronin in Hartford, and Mayor Elliker in New Haven, they got together with some other officials in Hartford, and also some family members who have lost loved ones through gun violence, street violence. And they finally, now we'll get into this here, but hallelujah, praise the Lord. If this was a tent revival, I'd be up front and I'd be speaking in tongues. I'd be shimmying and shaking all over the place. They finally got it here. A 10-point proposal, says here in the Connecticut Mirror. This is covered all over the state. We'll give you some of what the Mirror said here. A 10-point proposal developed by a working group of four Democratic mayors active in CCM is a political departure coming after a dozen years of reforms combined with falling crime rates have shrunk the prison population in Connecticut. The mayors and moms calling for reforms to target repeat gun offenders. Again, the gun offenders. We talk about it all the time here on the show with local and state leaders. You can talk all you want about falling prison numbers and about this stat and that stat. People don't care. They don't care about the damn numbers. What they do care about is hearing these stories about some of these same repeat offenders. And it's not a lot of people. It's not. That's one thing that the folks participating in this said yesterday, and they're right. It's not a lot of people. I was told that years ago. I told you when I used to have regular sit-downs with Mayor John DeStefano in New Haven, and I've heard that from other mayors as well. Luke Bronin, I chatted with him a few years back on this, and he said the same thing. It's not a hell of a lot of people in Hartford, even in Bridgeport. Joe Ganim said that to me once. It's not 95, 96, 97, 99% of the good to hardworking people in Bridgeport. But again, they're already on the defensive, and this is why we should be worried here. We'll tell you what they want to do, but there are already the usual folks in Hartford, and this is a prime example, folks. This is a prime example why I tell you, and I don't care what party you are, Democrat, Republican, liberal, conservative, whatever, I tell you, yeah, the sexy race, the politically sexy race in Connecticut every 4 years is always the governor. And I get it. I understand that the governor is the CEO. He or she sets the tone for the state. I get that. I understand that. But I'm telling you over and over and over and over again, and this is a prime example. I'm telling you over and over again that the best laid plans, plans that you and I can agree with across party lines, because there are some plans that belong not to the Republican Party or the Democratic Party, they belong to the Common Sense Party. Even some of those plans that make perfect sense to you and I are threatened, are poo-pooed by, what do I tell you, the legislative leaders in Hartford. Those people, primarily, but not always, primarily on the Democratic side, who've been there for years and years and years. And some of these people are never supplanted. They wake up in the morning and they get reelected. So we're already seeing pushback on now against things that sound like common sense to you and I. The mayors of Bridgeport, Hartford, New Haven, and Waterbury, Joe Ganim, Justin Elliger, Neil O'Leary, Luke Bronin, and leaders of the CCM announced the policies during an afternoon news conference yesterday. Mayor Bronin outlining a set of policies originating from a task force convened by CCM last year. The resulting proposals. Now, you tell me, and I'll go over the proposals one by one here as we get up and underway. Of course, the phones are open at 203-333-9422, 333-WICC. And again, these are proposals. Some people in the legislature are going to love them. Other people are already poo-pooing them. But this is concentrated on the kind of person, the guy or gal, it's usually a guy, right, that I read about, I tell you about here on the show, and you get down to the bottom of the story, and police say so-and-so was convicted X amount of years ago, or so-and-so has a lengthy criminal record. And people like you and I, just, you know, calm, everyday, law-abiding people saying, well, why are they on the street? Why weren't they given a longer sentence? What is going on here with this? And we always get the, you know, the soft shoe, the two-step from the Democratic leaders in Hartford. Well, you know, yeah, but there are other factors at play here. Okay, why were they out? Why were they able to make bond or make bail? So now you have some suggestions to tighten that up. And again, I don't know why it took so long. Why? You explain to me. What do you think? Why does this take so long? 203-333-9422. 333-WICC. Do we have people amongst us, governing us, who are more concerned with just closing jails? Just making sure, empty cells, got to get them out. And saying the hell with public safety? I don't get it. The resulting proposals, according to Mayor Luke Bronin of Hartford, all attempt to crack down on a small number of individuals responsible for a disproportionate amount of gun violence. Eric, can we get Mr. Drumroll here? Can we crank him up? Because, boy, get ready for this. You ready for this? This is startling. Folks, I'm telling you, this takes your breath away. They want to focus on, make sure I'm okay here. They want to focus on those with a history of earlier offenses and those free on bail or out on probation or parole. Amazing, isn't it? They finally woke up. Maybe. The proposals, now let's get into the specifics here. Some of these specifics that, I don't know, on the surface sound good to me. Some people already don't like them. You tell me, 203-333-9422. Here are some of the ideas. And I've switched to a story from the Connecticut News Junkie, but here are some of the ideas. The proposals from the mayors, again, mayors Ganim in Bridgeport, Elliger in New Haven, Bronin in Hartford, and O'Leary in Waterbury, include raising from 10 to 30% the percent of a bond that a person with a history of serious firearm offenses must post in order to be released from jail. See, and again, I've tried to explain this to you folks. A lot of people are unfamiliar with bond and posting bond because you don't get arrested. Shocking. You're not a criminal. I know. Yeah, I know. Isn't that weird? Usually, if you see somebody was released on a $50,000 bond or $100,000 bond, they're only posting 10% of that. So they're posting $5,000. Well, where do they get $5,000? Well, they sign over their car as collateral. Or they're only posting $10,000. Where do they get $10,000? Well, if they got some money in the bank and they sign over their car and, you know, they sign over, a small amount of stock they may own. Who knows? So what these mayors want to do is they say, hey, for a certain amount of people here, for a certain amount of people who have a sickness, so you're starting already with a small universe here, certain amount of people who have serious firearm offenses in their past. In other words, oh, look at this file. This person has been in before, and so they're so far, they're a career criminal. Okay, so they can still get out. You got to be careful here with the unreasonable bond and or bail violating the Constitution. But we're going to raise that level from 10% to 30%. Is that crazy? Is that nuts? The mayor's proposals also include new rules for individuals with a history of gun offenses. Again, the repeat offenders. In those cases, they would make it easier for the state to remand the individuals to state custody if they're arrested on serious firearm charges. That's fancy lingo for saying, hey, you're already out, you have a history, and you've been rearrested again, get back to jail. Right? Get back to jail. What's wrong with that? Other concepts include speeding up prosecution of people charged with firearms offenses and tweaking the mandatory sentencing. See, this is my favorite here. This is one I've been on for a while. Tweaking the mandatory sentence for people convicted of criminal gun possession to prevent them from being eligible for the early release programs. Keep them in jail. Now, all common sense stuff, right? Right? If we have people that again and again and again are arrested on serious gun charges, we have to come down harder on them. Yet, there were those people in Hartford yesterday, and one name is going to be familiar. You've heard of him before. There were going to be people saying, hey, let's not go too fast on this because, you know, we should be cutting down on crime other ways. All right, we welcome back this gentleman who's been with us several times before on subjects just like this, Republican State Rep. Greg Howard, member of the General Assembly. He's also the ranking member on public safety, which, of course, has a lot to do with criminality and criminal laws in this state. Greg is also, among other things, a police officer as well, long career in emergency medicine and also law enforcement here, so he's one of the guys that sees it from both angles in Hartford. Hey, Greg, it's Paul again. Good afternoon. How are you?
Good afternoon, my friend. I'm doing well. It's great to talk to you.
Well, thanks, great. Thanks for coming on in short notice. All right, Greg, so I've been tossing this around with my listeners here for the first 90 minutes. Stuff proposed yesterday, not by some group of policy wonks or, you know, some university from CCM, along with the mayors of Bridgeport, Waterbury, New Haven, and Hartford. Greg, I don't know about you, but as a first step, the step I'm reading, the steps I'm seeing, a lot of it makes sense to me. But what are your thoughts?
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I put out a public post this morning. I applaud those four mayors. You know, we make a lot of hay, Paul, about Republicans and Democrats today. And you know, firearms laws and gun rights and gun control sit at the crux of some of those, you know, very partisan disagreements. But for four Democratic mayors in this state, from our four largest cities to come forward, and I'm paraphrasing them, but effectively say, look, the real problem with gun violence is that we have people who are criminals are out committing crime with guns who are already legally or were already lawfully banned from or prohibited from acquiring firearms are the ones perpetrating most of our gun crime. So effectively, they're saying new restrictive gun laws is not the answer. What they need to do is prosecute the gun laws that we have. And I, as you've heard me say in your show before, what else was interesting is they effectively said Connecticut's history of a soft on crime approach is not working relevant to gun crimes. It's not working. And, you know, I could not agree with them more. I'm happy to say that. I don't care that they're Democrats and I'm a Republican. The fact of the matter is that they hit the nail on the head with the real problem with gun violence. And I applaud them for coming forward and saying it.
And those mayors and also Patrick Griffin, Greg, the chief state's attorney, said basically it's not everybody in a city, but it is a small cadre of people, Greg, repeat offenders in these cities that are giving these cities bad names. And attorney Griffin said basically urban 18 to 34-year-old males who are repeat offenders and offending oftentimes, Greg, when they're out already on parole or they're awaiting the adjudication of their cases, and this is giving entire metro areas, Greg, a bad name.
Yeah, and he, you're exactly right. And the chief state's attorney also pointed out that 70%, according to recent studies in the largest cities, 70% of identified shooters and gun violence victims, you know, conversely, had previously been convicted of felonies. And we have to remember, any person in the country, but certainly in Connecticut, who's been convicted of a felony is prohibited by both federal and federal law and state law from possessing a firearm at all. And, you know, for the chief state's attorney to come out and say that, I think was outstanding. But again, you know, we have to look at a broader spectrum here because, you know, they also rolled out in their proposals, some mandatory minimum sentences and some bond initiatives, and we are actually discussing bond in Judiciary Committee this year about violent offenses all around. But they rolled out sort of how bond would operate. You know, raising as it stands right now, it's you're entitled to 10% of your bond if it's cash up front.
Yeah.
You know, raising that to 30. But all of this. You have to prosecute the gun crime. So I think, you know, and I'll say for your listeners who maybe not have heard me in the past, the rate at which we nolly or dismiss, and those are terms that are used in the judicial system, nolly meaning a prosecutorial discretion not to prosecute, and dismiss means it was just completely thrown out by the judge. We nolly or dismiss a staggering amount of gun-related crimes. 74%, I think, off the top of my head of crimes, you know, in the last year to 3 years of people who were found illegally in possession of a firearm, meaning that they have a statutory prohibitor like being a convicted felon, 74% of them were nollied or dismissed.
Three quarters, Greg. I'm going to stop you and say that again. I'll basically round it up. 75% nollied or dismissed on gun charges.
Yeah, I mean, there's other, you know, staggering numbers. 97% of cases for illegally transferring a long gun. I mean, the number of cases that are nollied or dismissed is really staggering. And there's a lot that goes into that. There's a lot of pretrial issues and diversionary programs. But for the mayors to come forward, standing with the chief state's attorney and say our soft on crime approach is not working in gun violence. It's just not.
Yes, and the mayor of Bridgeport gathering along with the mayors of Waterbury, New Haven, and Hartford yesterday at the Capitol, along with members of the Connecticut Conference of Municipalities, and also, importantly, friends and family members of victims who have lost their lives to gun crime in our four largest cities, to put across what a lot of folks would say are common sense and moderate ways to maybe get the multi-time offenders who continue to offend off of these streets. Greg Howard joins us. He's a guest on this show frequently, Republican state rep. He's a ranking member on the Public Safety Committee that reviews proposals like this and debates them. Greg's also a police officer as well. Greg, we started to talk about, I guess, some of the signs coming yesterday from some influential members of the General Assembly that you work with up there. There seems to already, Greg, correct me if I'm reading this wrong, but there seems to be, at least in my mind, according to quotes I've seen from people, kind of almost asking for a quid pro quo. Well, we may consider this, but we need more funding for programs. And it wasn't really warmly received by some people. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, that happens in Hartford, Paul, all the time, right? It's you know, everything's an all or nothing proposition up there. Like, it's either we need to be aggressive about our prosecution of gun crime, or we need to prevent gun crime. So the reality is both. You know, we need to continue to our efforts that we do already with funding. Project Longevity is a great example. Our Project Longevity posts some really great success numbers at preventing gun violence. But we also have to confess that our prevention efforts are not going to be foolproof. People are still going to commit crime. And whether or not my colleagues want to admit it, aggressively prosecuting crime is a deterrent for others. That's the hard entire judicial system is set up and has been set up for years. So it should come as no surprise that when we get soft on prosecution and we get soft on crime and we, you know, romanticize criminals sometimes the way that we do in this state, that, you know, that deterrent factor kind of goes away. So when that deterrent factor goes away, our efforts, you know, in prevention such as Project Longevity, we'll see, you know, a diminished result because, you know, we're diminishing some of our deterrents. So the reality is we do need to do both things. We need to aggressively prosecute violent crimes, period, mm-hmm. but we're talking about gun crimes today, and we need to be serious about it. And then we need to continue our efforts to try to prevent them from happening. Look, I would love it if we never had to arrest a single person for committing a gun crime because they didn't happen. I would love that. But one thing that we do know is nobody ever has proven to me or anybody else that restricting law-abiding people stops criminals from committing crime and anything. You know, we're talking about in gun violence now, but we have conversations about catalytic converters all the time. and it's, you know, you should hear it. It's everybody, well, it's the recyclers this and the, you know, the people leave.
No, it's the criminal. It's the criminal.
Yeah, nobody ever wants to blame the guy or the gal that climbed under the car with a die grinder, with a battery grinder and cut the thing off or with a saw. Nobody wants to blame that person ever. So for those, again, I like to take the opportunities when I have them to commend my they're not necessarily my colleagues, but my fellow elected officials, if you will, from the other side of the aisle, and these four particular mayors, because they're exactly right, and I am grateful that they had the courage to stand up and say it. And I intend on supporting their proposals.
And Greg, finally here, look, you're a police officer, and I know. And one thing, and I talked about this before our interview, Greg, you know, you have these, whether they're so-called leaders of certain communities, elected or appointed, otherwise, we get that. You know, that's fair and square. But I'm sure they don't speak for a unanimity of thought. I mean, Greg, I'm sure you've encountered areas in your police work where if you went there and said, hey, we finally got this guy off the street, or we finally got these two bangers in and they're going away for a while. Greg, I'm guessing nobody says to you, well, Officer Howard, how much state funding are we getting? Like, they don't care. They just want they want safe streets, since everybody, no matter what color, they want to be able to walk their dog or sit on the stoop at night and relax.
Yeah, so that's exactly what happens. And, you know, you talk about – so some of my Democratic colleagues – and I think you bring up a good point, right? So some of my Democratic colleagues will say, well, you know, some crimes are on the decline. Well, that may be true, but in suburban areas of Connecticut, they're seeing crimes they haven't seen before. So and I tell my legislative colleagues this when I used to train young police officers, I tell them and I teach my sons, every person's perception is their reality. And so you have to work within it. And you have to understand that. And certainly as a legislator, you have to understand that, and you have to help folks understand the true reality. Then that's everyone's reality, whether you're black or white, whether you're from suburbia or from one of our urban cities, or you're from the Litchfield Hills or New Haven. It doesn't matter. You have to understand everybody's perception and work within it. But one thing that we can all agree on is everybody, no matter where they live in the state of Connecticut, should be able to walk out their front door, walk out to their driveway. Their vehicle should be there. They should not get shot on their way. They should get into their car and drive to wherever they're going with a catalytic converter intact. Yeah. And nobody should be taking their things or causing them harm. That's what we agree on. How do we get there? And again, it's a multi-pronged approach. The best approach to crime has been and will always be preventative measures that are backed up by aggressive enforcement. But unfortunately here, we abandon the enforcement way too much. And again, that's essentially what these mayors are saying. You know, we have people that are arrested on gun crimes that shouldn't have had a gun in the first place. So they're committing a crime. They've already a convicted felon. They're now in possession of a firearm. They going out and commit a gun-related crime with that firearm. We're putting them back on the streets to do it again. And we can't understand why our gun crime numbers are up. Well, I can. Yeah. We're taking gun criminals and putting them back on the street. I mean, my kid's in sixth grade. He could tell me that.
Yeah. Hey, Greg, thank you. Greg Howard, State Rep, Republican Stonington, also a police officer. He's the ranking member on public safety. Greg, good to chat with you. I'm sure we'll be talking about this down the line. Thank you, Greg. Appreciate it.
Pleasure to have it. Have a great day.
Thanks, Greg Howard there, who is, you know, a gentleman who talks about crime policy while he is at the same time a police officer. How refreshing. A citizen legislature, that's what we're based on here, at least in the U.S. House and the state houses around the country. So some of the opinion leaders across the state from actually both sides of the political spectrum are chatting about this proposed bill that I told you about. I think it was last week or the week before, that's been proposed by some high-profile Democrats in Hartford and say, hey, maybe we should go to mandatory voting in the state. Wouldn't that be a great thing? And if, I'm sorry, this is pure lunacy. And if you decide not to vote, you would have to explain yourself, Lucy. Why don't you vote, eh? Explain yourself. And then if that was not good enough, you'd have to pay a fine. What? Joining us right now to talk about his latest op-ed, how bad an idea is compulsory voting, let me count the ways, our friend Terry Calgill from the Connecticut News Junkie. Terry, good afternoon. How are you?
Hey, not bad. You know, Lucy, you have some splaining to do.
Why are they going to splain about this? Terry, in the land of strange ideas that is our beautiful Capitol Dome in Hartford, this one's a little, you know, I thought this would have like one little known legislator signing on to it. Hey, I'll do you a favor. I'll run this bill out there. It'll only be me and it'll be fine. Well, that's not, there's some pretty prominent people signed to this.
Yeah, sure. I mean, you've got Josh Elliott and a bunch of others. I don't remember off the top of my head the full list, but they are respected legislators. Many of them have been in there for a while.
Mm-hmm.
Where they got this idea, I don't know for sure, but I suspect it has to do. It came from the state of Washington, and there's a proposal floating around there to make voting mandatory. And also, there are some nations that do have mandatory voting. As I noted, believe it or not, North Korea has mandated voting.
I'm shocked.
Yeah,
oh. Who do they vote for?
High approval ratings, you know?
But Terry, look, in all seriousness, we've been watching this stuff for years, and you bring out a very cogent point in your column that we equate voting with a form of speech. And what are you going to force us to weigh in on something that we may not care about?
Well, yeah, I mean, and that's I did some research and I found some scholarly articles about this concept of mandatory voting. And if you consider voting to be an act of free speech, and I think you could make a very good case that it is free speech, then mandatory voting would essentially be compelled speech. So I would imagine that if this were challenged and it went up to the Supreme Court, given the current composition of the court especially, I think it would be rejected on First Amendment grounds. And I think you could make a very good case that it is a violation of our freedom of speech as guaranteed by the First Amendment.
Terry Calgill checking in with us every so often. We like to have him on to pick his brain about what his op-eds are about. This one, how bad an idea is compulsory voting. Let me count the ways. Terry talking about it today with me, and I talked about it when I first saw it posted at the Connecticut News Junkie a couple of weeks ago, that there is a bill being proposed out there that, again, is not a foreign idea, as Terry said, that would mandate voting. And Terry, this is one of these things it makes me kind of laugh. If dear God, you decided not to vote, you would have to explain yourself. And then if the explanation, Terry, wasn't good enough, there would be a monetary fine. Really? My God.
Yes, a monetary fine. You know, there was an earlier proposal by State Senator Will Haskell that said that there would be a fine of $20 if you, you know, didn't have a valid excuse.
Yeah.
And or 2 hours of community service.
Jeez.
And but I just I look at it and I can't. I mean, you know who? And this is Kevin Renio also wrote a column on this, and he pointed out, and I did not repeat it in my column. I probably would have if I had remembered it. But one of the sponsors of the bill was Senator Saud Anwar, and he's also sponsoring a bill to extend the terms of state senators from 2 years to four. So does he want more voting or less? It sounds like he wants less voting when it benefits him, and he wants more voting when it benefits him or maybe his colleagues. I don't know. But there's just all kinds of crazy things going on in Hartford. But this one really stuck with me. And the other question I think that's very important to ask is, what is the value of a coerced vote?
Yes.
You know, because what these folks, and there have been studies done on non-voters, and they tend to be less informed. Mm-hmm. They tend to be alienated. They're not really paying attention for the most part. They don't think there's a real difference between the two parties. They think the system is rigged. What is the value of forcing people like that to vote? They're obviously not well-informed, most of them. And so why is that a good thing necessarily? I just don't see the wisdom in it. The only thing I can assume is that the people who are sponsoring it think somehow that it's going to benefit them or their party.
And on that note, Terry, you mentioned Saud Anwar. I don't know him in particular. I met him a couple of times when I was working doing this stuff in Hartford. Nice enough guy. We chatted for a little bit. But he gave a quote to Dan Haar at Hearst Connecticut Media. And this, Terry, you know, you read this kind of quote, and I'm like, really? He said, quote, "Sometimes a small organized minority can just move the polity in the wrong direction, and we have to have an intervention from the larger society to share perspectives," unquote. What's he talking about? That's one of those. I mean, and I said in jest to a friend of mine, you know, somewhere Chairman Mao and Joe Stalin are smiling. But in all seriousness,
yeah,
that's frightening that a state legislature legislator would say that.
Yeah, I mean, he's you know, people. Whenever things don't go the politician's way, and this happens all the time, they don't blame their policies. They blame messaging, or they blame maybe foul play on the part of a very organized minority, like perhaps that's what the senator is talking about.
Mm-hmm.
They always blame it on marketing or messaging rather than actually look at the policy and say, hey, you know what? Maybe the policy isn't actually popular, and maybe there's a good reason for that.
And Kevin Rennie in his piece, and by the way, we're talking with Terry Calgill from the Connecticut News Junkie. Kevin, in his piece, Terry, you probably saw this, he brings up a good point, too, that both major parties in this state don't really, Kevin, Terry, make it easy for people who may want to actually get in the process. And I've had people tell me, Terry, I don't know what your experience is, but I've had very intelligent, very high-income people tell me they don't vote because there's nobody new. They see the same people there on the ballot every year. And so the major parties have a play in this at all, as well.
Yeah, they do. And there are a lot of people who don't see a whole lot of difference between the parties. And that particularly is the case with non-voters, as this Pew study and the Knight Foundation study revealed. I think they're alienated for a good reason in the sense that in many ways there isn't a great deal of difference between the two parties. The difference is largest on the national level. But in states where we actually have to make things work, mm-hmm. and you know, we have to balance budgets and we have to make sure the trains run on time, I think that the two parties are a little closer together because they have to work together. On the federal level, they don't really have to work together. As you're seeing right now, there's very little action going on in Washington legislatively. There's a lot of investigations, but it's very quiet otherwise.
And in case you missed it, the 2024 campaign is already started. I mean, we have Nikki Haley running for the White House already. Grab the popcorn, Terry, or the pork rinds, you know, whatever you'd prefer, you know?
Oh, yeah. And, you know, the list of people who are going to run is long, or who are said to be going to run is long. Nikki Haley has joined the fray. Difficult to have a whole lot of respect for her because she came out very strongly against Donald Trump and then basically said never mind because he was willing to appoint her U.N. ambassador.
Well, again, that's what I said, Terry, earlier before we hooked up here. I said, yeah, but all that fades away when somebody calls and says the president would like to speak to you about being the U.N. ambassador, right? And we all go, okay, right?
Yes. Well, yeah, sure. I mean, she wanted it for her her resume because, you know, governor is the one real weak spot in a governor running for president. They don't have the most of them don't have the foreign policy experience. Now she's got 2 years as UN ambassador. Truth be told, that's not really that important a job. I think it sounds very lofty, but it's not that big a deal. Nonetheless, it is foreign policy experience and she can use that to convince people. She is she's a governor, so she was. So they have to really get things done. And I think governors make better presidents, if you want my opinion, than legislators. Because legislators, most of them have never run anything bigger than their own offices. And governors have had to run things. Being a governor is a very hard job. Being a senator, not so much.
Yeah, finally, Terry, the staff in your office that I spoke to today before I lined this interview up, they told me, though, no, you're a great you can organize, Terry. Your staff told me today they love working for you, so don't downgrade yourself.
My staff consists of a woman named Alexa and another one named Siri.
There you go. Folks, check
they
out.
Great dictation.
Yes, they do. And they're always awake, too. Something's weird with that. How bad an idea is compulsory voting? Terry Cowgill from the Connecticut News Junkie. Terry, good to chat with you. We'll talk down the road. Thank you.
All right, Paul. Take care.
Take care. There you go. Check it out, folks. See, this compulsory voting thing, you've got people on opposite sides of the aisle looking at this and saying, compulsory voting. Please, please, if you don't want to vote, I'm not going to twist your arm to vote. I hope you do. Maybe in a few. Like I said, I knew a few people on both sides of the aisle. I had friends of mine who were incredibly motivated to vote for Donald Trump. They hadn't voted in years. And I had friends of mine on the other side of the aisle that were incredibly motivated to vote for Bernie Sanders. And I asked them, when's the last time you voted? They said, I don't vote or I haven't voted in years. So maybe it's the message. Again, maybe more people will vote if they feel it makes a difference or a candidate actually connects with them.